Hello, Space Burgers, and welcome to the Space Cave. I'm David Huntsberger, your local comedian and host of the monthly variety show, The Junk Show, if you live in Los Angeles. The next one is, I believe, this Sunday, March 13th. Got a great lineup. Hope to see you there. All right, let's get into it. Okay, so chatting more with Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E. So it's like the first part of Amber and then Rose. Is that your... real name?
Is Ambrose my real name?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. And then how, I mean, when you, I think this is pretty common, and I genuinely mean this as like a compliment, that when, I think a lot of people in your line of work, when they say, but I'm different, everyone kind of scoffs or rolls their eyes, but I think by virtue of you listening to this podcast, it unequivocally makes you different. Like you were saying last time we were chatting, that you see people and you're like, I don't want to entertain that person. I do that all the time in stand-up. If I see a crowd where I just look at them like, what is this person doing here in a Trump t-shirt or something like that? I want no part of it. And yet there's part of like the business that comes along with it. Like, well, you have to, and maybe that person will surprise you. Is it hard, like, when you tell people what you do you feel like they're judging you straight away?
Well, the one thing I don't like is when someone knows what I do and then they go tell someone else that I don't know or that anyone thought to me, because people do have their idea about dancers. I'm fine with dancers, but I know the stereotypes. And when people ask me what I do, I just kind of feel them out. Like, if I'm going to get a bunch of shit from them, then I'll say, you know, I do makeup or I write or something.
Sure.
Which I do, but that's not really where my most of my money comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not ashamed of it. I tell them, and maybe if they get to know me and they know what I do, then it's like, oh, well, she's not the stereotypical. Maybe other dancers aren't like this either, because they're not all like that. And just the same as like all the guys who come in the club, they're not all garbage. There are some good ones.
Yeah.
So, but it's funny that you say that about me listening to the podcast, because I listened to Greg Fitzsimmons' podcast for a really long time. And I remember it was like 5 years ago or something, and he was like, call in, let me know how you listen to the podcast, if you're working out, if you're, you know, running your errands, whatever it is. I listen to the podcast always while I'm sitting in a locker room full of loud girls, full of cigarette smoke, getting ready for work. That's how I listen to my podcast. And I just thought that was interesting.
Oh, wow, that is...
Yeah.
Did you hear me on his podcast, and that's how you got turned on to this one?
No, I heard you. I listened to Professor Blastoff.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, I heard you on that. I always, you know, obviously I wish you guys would have continued, because I thought it'd be a cool episode if you would talk about misophonia.
Say it again?
Misophonia, because, like, M-I-S-O-P-H-O-N-I-A.
Oh, right, okay.
When certain noises bother people, just because that's my thing. So,
Were you someone that was, because people used to eat, not me, but people used to eat into the microphones, and it would drive me insane, and other people would write in and be like, I have this condition, I cannot hear that, it drives me nuts. Is that how you felt?
Yeah, like that, or, I mean, just anything, like repetitive tapping, like someone's tapping their foot, even just seeing it out of the corner of my eye, just anything repetitive like that.
Yeah.
I don't love.
I have a lot of weird quirks like that, too, and, it can be frustrating, I'm sure, for people to be around, because, like, my girlfriend doesn't have any of those. I could be making any number of sounds, or, like, cracking my knuckles bothers people. She doesn't really get upset by that. But when people are, you know, like that sort of sound drives me nuts. Like a cat that's sort of cleaning itself, or someone chewing food.
Oh,
or,
that's the worst. My mom does that.
I have to, like, leave the room or turn up the volume on...
Yeah.
Some device.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to keep
headphones everywhere I go. So.
Oh, and therefore, it's critical. You have a need for podcasts to tune out the rest of the world.
To drown out all the little tiny noises that are loud to me. Yeah.
Have you thought about writing a book at all? I know, I mean, obviously, Diablo Cody did that and had her
present. Yeah, she did that, but I didn't read the book or really know anything about it, but I'm going to talk shit for a second. She did it, like, as she did, so, like, she went into it just, like, for a little bit to write a book, right? Like, I don't...
Kind of, yeah, yeah. Like, it was a project.
Yeah, so I think when you're doing it that way, it's like, you're not really a stripper writing about your experience. You're someone who, I don't know, it's kind of already planned.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do, and I have a nice camera that I'm still getting to learn, to making videos and taking nice photos, and I really want to, I kind of want to do, like, sort of a documentary. I was just about different kind of dancers and when I travel to different clubs and stuff. So I brought my camera equipment with me.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm trying to do that. And, yeah, and writing.
Well, like you were saying, the preconceived notions about the guys who are there, and it's, like, Russian mobsters, and it's the affliction guys, or it's really lonely, pathetic guys who give all their money to these girls who, and then the girls are characterized in movies as, like, hey, honey, I'll be off after this, why don't you stick around, like, giving out this fake kind of flirty vibe, and then they have, like, a cocaine addiction, and then behind the scenes, they've got all this... just a horrible childhood and on it. Like, those are the ways they portray it over and over. And maybe it wouldn't be as entertaining if they just had a really functional club where all the girls had come into it with, like, diplomas and degrees and filled out resumes. But that's one thing that Diablo Cody said is, like, the girls really took care of each other. It was really kind of a family vibe in there. And behind the scenes, like, girls are really funny. And
yeah.
Do you see that club to club? Like, do you know immediately, like, oh, no, this is going to be a drug place? Or, oh, this feels like this will be a home base?
Yeah. So my home club, I'm really close with the girls there, obviously, because I've been there for years. And one of my best friends works there, too. And so, yeah, so in that way, it's fun. And even this club that I auditioned for the other night, all the girls there were super sweet. So, yeah, it just really depends on where you go. And I go to more of the nicer clubs. And the nicer clubs, they don't want any drama. So if they sense that a girl's maybe catty, then they'll go ahead and just let them go. So I don't get a lot of that. But as far as the men come in, before this past year in 2015, if someone ever said to me, oh, you're jealous and you're nervous, these guys, they must be, like, creep you out. I'm like, no. But this past year, they all came out once. And they were just creeps and garbage and dirt and mean. And I just have no tolerance for it. But I also realized that going into a strip club is a good sort of barometer for how someone really is. Because if you're going in and you're a gentleman and you're really nice, I think that's how you are in the quote-unquote real world. But when you go in and you just think that the girls are objects or whatever it is, and you just act like an asshole, then I think that you're an asshole in real life, even if you pretend to be nice out in the real world. And I think that's just how I view people now. Like, I don't know, how I act in the club is how they truly are as a person, good or bad.
Yeah, I like when there is a place like that, that you do see, you feel like you get a peeled back version of people, like, oh, this is the real you, like the person that comes in here and you're a jerk, like this is the real you. That'd be interesting for you to see that over and over, and you said, like, you've developed a thick skin for it, but does it get to you at points where, like, what outweighs it? Is it the money? Is it just the lifestyle and the freedom that you can travel, or what makes the good outweigh the bad?
Yeah, it is all those things, because I do, when it's good, I do make really good money, and I'm able to support myself and travel, and I went to school in England for the past 2 summers for something I wanted to do, and I didn't have to get loans or anything, and so it's nice, and I'm able to help out my friends and my family, and I do like that sort of lifestyle, and I do meet interesting people, you know, even they're all businessmen, they're married, and it's interesting, because a lot of them tell me the same story about, like, their married lives, and how they live and how it's just sort of monotonous and their wife, and then they don't really have sex anymore, but it's like cheaper to keep her. So it's like, it's kind of a repeat all the time, but it's, I don't know, it's kind of interesting. And
does it give you a jaded,
sort of like a,
sorry, does it give you an itch, like a sort of a jaded view on marriage of, like, oh, well, this, it's just going to be so boring.
well, I don't ever want to get married anyway, and I don't want kids, and I never really have. So that, to me, is an issue. I don't know that I would ever, I don't really ever want to get married, but maybe that's part of it, but I don't know. I feel like it's strange to be with one person forever when you have so many different, if you have so many different types that you're attracted to.
Yeah, I think that, like, the experiences you have end up becoming, like, not unavoidable, but indefensible, might be the right word, where, like, no matter how you feel, you'll be put in a situation where you go, well, yeah, I want to be with this person forever. I see a lot of that happen with friends of mine who are like, I'm polyamorous, I'm in open relationships, and then you see them a few months later, and like, I'm with this person, like, we really get along well. Yeah. And so I think there's always, it's like any career, or, you know, I think when you have a hard line stance on anything in life, a lot of times, like, the world almost seems to conspire to sort of challenge you with that. So, like, mm-hmm. if you were to say, I want to do this job forever, you might get, for whatever reason, just something falling into your lap, which, you know, the lap dance element, I mean, there's really opportunities for that there, but there, you know, who knows, there could be so many things that would spawn out of that, where your life in 10 years, you look back and go, oh, it's crazy where I thought I was and where I thought I was going to be. Do you have like a 10-year goal that way?
I used to, when I was young, when I was much more of an idealist. And when I was 18 is when I started working in the club. But I started out as a door girl, and then a waitress, and then a shop girl, and then a dancer. And that's sort of how it normally progresses. I've been dancing for 8 years, right? But, or 6 years. I've been in the club for 8.
Whoa, so you started, right toward the end of high school, and then...
I was in my first year of second semester of university. And I didn't even go in there looking for a job. My girlfriend came out from Chapel Hill on her spring break, and she said, let's go here. I want to do a bikini contest and I can win some money. So I went in with her, and they looked at me, and they're like, hey, you want a job? And I was like, yeah, actually, I do need a job. So they gave me the desk girl, like I check IDs and sell memberships. And I was super conservative. I was supposed to wear corset and booty shorts, but I didn't. I wore long pants and a sweater, and I brought my books with me, and I just read in between checking in people. So it's definitely an environment, like, once you get used to the environment, then you're like, oh, that's so bad, maybe I can wear a corset and be a waitress and sell shots, and then you just kind of get into it. But no, when I was 18, I thought by the time I was 26, I'd be, like, an actress or you know, a writer or something in the arts, successful, but that isn't really what happened, because I kind of used that club as a crutch.
I see.
And now I flew across country, and I'm in the sort of transition phase, right? I do this for just the money, but I kind of want to focus on other projects for the long term.
I have a whole new set of questions. We haven't done this before on the Space Cave, but let's continue this into a part 3 next week, because I have even more questions. We'll check back in with Ambrose. Ambrose, I told you I'd get to part 2 eventually. Isn't it compelling? And now I don't know. I don't know why I always ask you guys. I guess who knows what that's about. Isn't it compelling? What are you driving in your car going, yep, that's compelling. No, I think it's just nice to talk to someone with kind of this through line. So we'll get to part 3 down the road, maybe not next time, but soon. Find out, I mean, it's been a while ago since we spoke, so who knows where she is at now, what she's up to, how her career and her search for things are going. So maybe we'll, if she visits LA, have a Space Cave sit down, or if not, we can check in down the road. Or maybe you're not all that worried. I don't know. Again, you're driving in your car. I can't really, or why are you in your car? You could be anywhere. You could be on a subway. You could be you're out in a cave somewhere. We're all huddled together deep in the nether regions of space, away from the terrible things. I try not to invite any of them in here and have this be a place of just nice, comfortable parts of the world we can look at. That being said, don't read the book Missoula by John Krakauer if you are not looking for things that'll upset you, because you will be real furious. I love him, and I really enjoyed the book, but man, it really, I'd rather just celebrate that, how good he is, how great the writing is, but man, the the things that go on in small college towns. Anyway, I don't want to focus on that. Let's focus on something good. You guys, I don't know. I guess there hasn't been an episode yet that has aired. However, there have been episodes since this where I have mentioned that I'm drinking out of the official Space Cave mug. This is the indoctrination of that. This is the initial episode. And this is also the first guest I have had who reached out and said, hey, I'd like to be on the show. So this is the first of those. This was done via Skype. And I think we talk about the location and how it has a moderate little tie-in. And the beer we are drinking is delicious. And he randomly just selected two beers and said, which of these two do you like? I'm going to grab one of them. And one of them was Anderson Valley Winter Solstice. If you haven't had that, give it a try. It's real delicious. It's like candy, and it's good when it's kind of a little chilly outside, which it may still be depending on where you live. Anyway, guys, let's get to it. This is, we're talking about ceramics and ancient ceramics and kind of contemporary modern art involving ceramics, and the mug I have is made out of porcelain. It's real sturdy, but it's light. It's nice. You'll hear more about that. Anyway, from Elkins, West Virginia, here's my sit down with Brett Kern. Nice to hear your voice. We've only communicated digitally up until now.
Yeah, I know. It's creepy. I've heard your voice plenty.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were a Professor Blastoff listener, and then you've potentially heard hundreds of hours of me chatting.
yeah, I think so.
Cool. Well, I'm glad we're doing this. I've familiarized myself a bit. I didn't want to get too into it as far as like what you do and what I did look at. And I'd seen before when you first reached out, like you are just as, and I'm sure I've probably already mentioned this in the little lead up to this conversation, but just to recap, you do ceramic art. I'm drinking right now from a ceramic piece you made that's a mug that when you sent me a picture of it, I thought, oh, it looked like he piled up like string cheese size bits of clay kind of into columns and arranged them into a circle and then put a bottom on it and a handle. And so I was thinking like, this thing's going to be really heavy. That's cool. I wonder if there's like some native art like that originated that. And then I got it and it's a ceramic version of what would be a blow up thing. Like it has.
Yeah.
A little,
yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's it. Exactly. It's a little self-referential, you know? So if you look through my work, there's a lot of that like inflatable stuff, you know, that it's cast ceramic stuff, but it's made to look inflatable or it's cast from inflatables. And okay. I started to gain some notoriety for that sort of thing. But the reason I got into ceramics 11 years ago was handmade pottery. You know, I started working on the wheel and was throwing on the wheel and making pots on the wheel. And this mug that or stein that you're drinking out of is kind of a combination of those two things. So it's meant to be cool to look at on its own, but also a little bit of my story in each piece.
Whoa, cool. Wait, so let's go back then to the story, because like if I'm looking at it, it's hard for me, in some way, it's hard for me to describe exactly how an inflatable mug would really look and then derive from that, like your story, beyond just like that's how you got kind of a bit of notoriety is doing the blow up things. But how would you cast the, like, did you get a mug like this, blow it up, and then cast around it?
Yeah, sort of. It was a little bit of a hunt for this thing. It was not originally a mug, and that's a little bit of the reason I got into slip casting and casting ceramics, was turning things into functional pottery from things that weren't before. So it was actually an inflatable Jewish cylinder for like hand washing that I don't know how I stumbled upon it online, but I saw it and I said, that looks like a beer stein to me. I'm going to buy that. So got shipped from Israel and I haven't seen one since. So,
whoa, this is great. And how worried should I be that it's fragile? I mean, obviously I don't want to drop it, but I feel like even with the handle, like that it's smarter if I grab it around kind of the midsection of the stein itself. Is it pretty reliable with the handle?
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, it's porcelain. It's made out of the same stuff your toilet's made out of, so it should be pretty durable. Obviously, if you drop it, that wouldn't be good.
Yeah.
You know, but it can go in and out of a dishwasher.
Oh, you know, okay.
Ceramics is deceptively tough. I've had mugs before, you know, just working in the studio. I've had mugs I've dropped onto a concrete surface, and it bounced back up, and I caught it. So if it hits on the right angle, it's fine.
Man, if you had video of that.
Oh, I know. That's, no one was in the room. No one saw it.
No one will ever believe you. That's too preposterous. I dropped ceramic, it bounced back up, I caught it, and I wasn't even looking. I no-looked it.
I wish. No, I saw it. Slow motion, caught it.
Okay. Well, this makes me feel, and it looks in no way really like a Simpsons thing, and yet there's a part of it that just feels like this is the closest you could get. I guess the blue of the color, or it has like, you know, kind of a drawn feel about it. It's like you're holding a drawing, or you're holding a bit of, it doesn't seem so physically real. Then you hold it, you're like, nah, it's totally real. But looking at it, you're like, ah, was that sketched out of like color pencil or crayon or something? It has like that sort of a Simpsons look.
I'm glad you said Simpsons. I'm a huge Simpsons fan. But that's what drew me to the original object, was those vertical ridges on it that just kind of, I like looked like a Duff beer mug.
Right, yeah. Like that, isn't that old video game where you're like the barkeep? They have those same sort of mug steins, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like that. Well, we've gotten to the bottom of that. Okay.
A little bit of a play on like a traditional stein.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, even, and so then the part that would, so if you've had blow up inflatable sort of like pool items or anything like that before, you know that you blow into it, and then at some point you've got to like bend the little tab over that works as a plug, then push the plug part down flat so it's sort of flush with the side of the inflatable, which is always the worst because you end up losing air and then holding it with your thumb and then
it's
cold. But you can, there's one of those on there and it's gold. Do you like dip that part in gold?
I brush gold onto it. So there's this stuff called gold luster, and it kind of came out of Iraq, you know, hundreds of years ago. But it actually has like gold suspended in solvents, you know, so you have to wear a respirator on it so you don't breathe in toxic fumes. But you brush that on the glaze, you put it back in the kiln, and it heats up so that the glaze kind of melts a little bit, and then the gold fuses with the glaze, and so that's on there permanent too. That's the one thing. You don't want to put this in a microwave. Lightning bolts will start shooting out of that plug.
Okay, good. I was going to make a giant stein of hot chocolate, but I'm opting against it.
I like that
idea that someone would come into your studio and you're wearing like hazmat gear. What are you doing? I'm making a cartoonish inflatable ceramic stein. Get back. Yeah. This is important work.
Yeah, there's always a lot of like Bane references too when I'm wearing my respirator, or Breaking Bad references or anything like that.
Yeah. Isn't everything kind of like that? I mean, it could seem like a slight to say, well, you know, I'm making art. But anything you do that you're going to invest time in, you start to develop like a sense of seriousness to it, where you're like, I got to finish this. And then inevitably, whatever it is, regardless of what it is, it's kind of inconsequential. Do you think about that with art, or you just focus on, like what I do, before I guess I'll let you answer, is I just go, I just like doing it. I don't care if I'm taking it maybe a little too serious. I want to see this project finished. And I know it's kind of dumb in the grand scheme of things. What are your thoughts? How do you approach it that way?
I'm just having fun most of the time. You know, it's just very focused and directed fun, I think. But I get very focused and driven, but at the same time, I'm just, you know, making inflatable mugs and dinosaurs, or I'm sculpting Ninja Turtles or whatnot. You know, to me, it's just a more serious form of playing.
Yeah. I think that's the, to me, I mean, everyone's got their, it's very subjective, obviously, but I think that's, you know, when someone considers themselves a very serious artist in the process, and it drives people crazy, and it's more fun to see something that really grabs your attention, and then the person who made it's like, isn't this cool? Like, the, you know, that your art really, the Alf statue, the Ninja Turtle one you brought up, if people are familiar with you, and I would imagine there are a number of people listening that know you through, like, the Nerdist did that piece on you, and then your website, and the stuff is pretty unique, and it's mind-blowing, and yet, not I want to say simplistic, but it's just very familiar right away. Like, oh, well, that's Alf. That's Alf holding a cat. That's terrific. And then you look at the detail and, like, the intricacy of it, and it kind of combines those two things of sort of like fine art and then just silliness.
Yeah, I think, go back to The Simpsons, you know, they're a huge inspiration for me. Same with like Weird Al and things like that. People that are really smart and real, and they make things that are really well crafted, but they're also, they've got a layer of silliness to them, you know, so they get that respect from, I guess they're highbrow and lowbrow at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved when the South Park guys, after one of the years, they had won an Emmy, and then they did that episode about, like, taking gigantic shits, and then they, like, put an Emmy in it, like, on screen, just like, this is all ridiculous.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
So, before we get it, I want to get into your story and kind of back up a little bit, because there are two parts of it that are, I don't know, moderately intriguing or coincidental, I guess. One is the beer we're drinking, that you went and just kind of randomly selected a couple beers, and then one of them that you showed me, you sent the picture, was Anderson Valley Winter Solstice, which we're drinking right now, me out of the mug, you in
West Virginia. Have a matching mug on this end.
Oh, nice. Same color?
Different color, but same family.
Sweet. Mug buddies.
Yeah.
This is great. So we're drinking Anderson Valley Winter Solstice. I talked about this briefly on Professor Blastoff one time, where I was blown away by this beer, because I went in with a friend of mine. It was like right before the holidays. It was as chilly as LA gets, you know. It wasn't like that cold, but it's nice when there's just like a little chill in the air. And a friend of mine and I were kind of each headed home, had a lot of stuff to do, but we'd made plans to kind of get together. Not kind of get to, we had made plans to get together, and then we were kind of thinking maybe we should bail out because we both had to get home. And then we said, let's just stick to what people say when they say, let's grab a drink. Let's get one quick one, chat real quick, and we'll head away. And so we both kind of raced in there. We got there at like exactly the same time. The server came over. What can I get? I just looked at the first thing on the menu. That my friend did kind of the same thing. It was like a speed date almost. And then we started chatting, and the beer showed up, and I just kind of reached over the no look, similar to you catching the mug. I like just grabbed it and took a sip mid sentence, and then just had to stop myself, like, oh my God, that's incredibly good. And it's nice when anything does that, but especially like a beer felt pretty good in that moment. Like, again, with like the chill in the air, and then you know, sometimes you could have a conversation that way quickly, and then afterward go, the beer was, you know, I had to kind of muscle through it, or I don't remember it. But it was great that it kind of caught my attention like that. So I'm really glad you chose it. How are you enjoying it so far?
I love it. This is great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. It's like candy. I don't know what it is in. It's kind of a caramely kind of taste or something. It's really...
Yeah, I got to watch myself. It's going down real easy.
Well, yeah, we don't want to... So I don't. I do want people to pick it up. It's kind of hard to get, but if you can find it, it is really...
I found it in Ohio, so...
Oh, nice. So you're not... So that was the other thing that's kind of coincidental, is that... So the show Reactor that I did, one of the sketches we made was like kind of this green screen bit, and it was like taking advantage of like, I can be anywhere in the world. And one of the writers just randomly chose Elkins, West Virginia.
No way.
Yeah. And so when I saw the Stein arrive and saw the return said Elkins, I was baffled.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So a lot of synchronicities happening here today with the Mug Buddies.
Yeah, I got to look that up. Is that clip online? I couldn't watch Reactor. I don't have cable or anything.
Nor do I. Nor do to create a show that's trying to appeal to that sort of demographic of people who are progressive and into, you know, technology and what's forward thinking, and then to only have it available via cable was a tough one.
A little weird. Yeah, no, I enjoyed all the clips I saw. I just you know, I just couldn't watch it.
Yeah, no, in hindsight, I wish I had just tweeted out like links to go find it illegally or something, so people could at least see it and then make up their mind whether or not. But there were definitely a handful of people that were just like, I would have liked to have seen it. I had no access to it. And so cable, who knows what's going to happen there, whether it's going to figure itself out or if it's just going to quietly kind of go away. I mean, AM radio is still hanging around, so.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It'll maybe still be there. But yeah, I don't know if that clip is online, right? You just have to take my word for it, but that I at one point said, I'm in Elkins, West Virginia. I think I was at like the post office or a DMV or something like that in West Virginia. So we just green screened that in behind me. I don't know if they took that footage directly from the Elkins DMV, but wouldn't that be something?
That would be something. I've been there.
Yeah. And so wait, you got the beer in Ohio. Where are you currently?
I'm in Elkins, West Virginia. I'm in my house right now. I drove to Athens, Ohio. It's about a 3-hour drive, but I had work that was in a show, so I had to go deliver the work yesterday.
Oh, good, man.
I've been there before, so I knew there was a nice grocery store that had a pretty wide selection of beer, so I just went in there and picked what looked cool.
You did very well. I'm highly impressed.
Yeah, there was a mutant bear deer on the front of it, which kind of drew me in.
Yeah, I love that. I had a dream about a bear. That's my most frequent dream is bears. But it was when I, and yeah, and they're always kind of scary in my dreams. And then whenever I see them, like there's a wine called Bear Boat. It's just this bear and I think a person hanging out in a boat. It's pretty good. It might be two bears in a boat, but I will buy that wine anytime I see it just because of the label. And so Anderson Valley, it's the bear on Anderson Valley has like antlers, deer antlers. Or elk, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Or there is possibly a deer standing directly behind it
that we can't see. Oh, yeah. And then it's like a peaceful bear because it's like, hey, let's share some water, deer that's right to my right. You're cool. Man, I like that. I hope that's the case, that it's not a freakish, equal like more terrifying than usual bear, but instead like a real peaceful bear that just likes caramel beer.
Yeah, I think we could learn a lot from that bear and that deer.
So, well, now I'm even more fascinated with your, because I think with your career and your trajectory and how you got started, and I think, you know, for me as like a comedian and surrounded by actors and people that are in film, everyone is in LA under some variety of excitement or enthusiasm or just like, yeah, you kind of have to end up here. And so there are a lot of people that sort of bemoan that and kind of go, oh, I would love to leave. I'd love to grow a garden. I'd love to just be like someplace where, or people in New York, I think are kind of the same way, but you kind of reconcile to yourself like, ah, I sort of have to be here. And so to be able to have a career in art and be kind of anywhere you want, namely Elkins, West Virginia. How did you end up there? Are you from there?
No, I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania, originally.
Okay, I've heard
I grew up there. I ended up coming to West Virginia for grad school. I went to West Virginia University and graduated in 2010 from there. Mm-hmm. And then I lived in Montana for a year doing this artist residency at this place called Red Lodge Clay Center. And then...
Whoa. That's cool.
Yeah, it was nice living in Montana.
That's such a romantic lifestyle you've got going so far. Sorry to interrupt you. Continue, oh, but I want to go back to that. That's pretty great.
Okay, we can go back, yeah. And then, you know, I actually got a teaching job here at a college, Davis and Elkins College, and that's what brought me back to Elkins. Someone was looking for sort of a sculpture ceramics professor, and they contacted WVU, and I was referred to them. So I sent along my resume, and I showed up here, and I've been here for the last 5 years.
Whoa, so right out of school, you got pretty much straight into teaching, or I guess out of the residency, the 1 year.
Yeah, I did the residency and then teaching, and I started as an adjunct for 2 years, so I was just kind of living in extreme poverty and teaching classes every once in a while, and then I snuck in. You know, I came in, I convinced them, they hired me full-time after 2 years.
Well, how'd you convince them? What was your, were you holding up things you'd made going, come on,
Yeah, that was pretty much it. I'd like to think that I worked hard and the students enjoyed me, so we'll go with that.
Yeah. I mean, how do you, so art being as subjective as it is, and I mean, how can you feel successful as a teacher beyond just people comprehending what you're saying? Do you need to see it manifest in their work?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are two approaches, you know, because I'll teach people that aren't art majors and they're not going to be artists. And I think with them, you know, what I try to do is at least give them an appreciation for art and for artists and for making art, you know, at least so they know how tough it is, the work that goes into it and the passion that goes into it, mm-hmm. you know, and then they leave my class and hopefully have a better appreciation for it. And then, you know, with people that want to become artists, it's in their work. It's, you know, it's based on where they go, you know, because I'm kind of setting them up to maybe go to grad school or to do an artist residency like I had done.
Do you try to, you know, get a little bit more out of them, or do you serve as kind of a bumper and kind of guide them and steer them a little bit, or you know, is it a case by case thing?
Oh, I push them. It depends on the person, you know, and I'm learning how to teach too. You know, I'm 5 years out of grad school. I didn't do too much. I taught while I was in grad school, but we only had a few classes about teaching, and then obviously you go out into the real world and you try to apply the things and it's all different. But, you know, one of the things I'm trying to get better at is telling the students what's going to be expected from them eventually if they do go on to grad school or if they do have to make a living at this, and giving them all of the tools that they're going to need to do those things. And then I just kind of have to sit back and wait for them to get passionate about it.
That can be frustrating. I mean, because art, you know, to some people is inconsequential and that's what they enjoy about it. And other times, like, the inconsequential elements of life as a whole really pull them back to art as like, well, I like this, and so I'm going to spend my existence doing this. And I would imagine as a teacher, like, watching people fluctuate, or especially if they have a talent or an ability, and then going, you know what, I'm going to go back and run my family's construction business or something.
Yeah.
Like, oh no, you're good. Like, this matters.
Yeah. It's one of those things too. People come in, they're like, oh, I just bought Star Wars Battlefront. I played that for 10 hours. I'm like, oh, you could have made so many things in those 10 hours.
Yeah. I mean, we're probably similar in that way, and I find myself you know, getting upset with myself that, like, oh, I wasted that time, or sometimes I need to waste time, like I need to loathe myself a little bit to have a little bit of motivation. And so I guess everyone as an artist, and not to consider myself one, but when I do artistic things, I need to, like, build up a little bit of energy to do it. And so as a kid, were you always kind of playing around with things, clay or otherwise, building things, repainting? Like, what was in you from the beginning that just made you know, like, art is how I want to spend it, my life?
Yeah, you know, I don't think there ever was a conscious decision to become an artist or to make that my life's direction. It was just, I was always drawing dinosaurs and Ninja Turtles, which I guess not much has changed now, I'm just sculpting them, but I was just always doing those things. I was always, you know, watching TV and drawing or playing around. I hated school. I hated every other type of learning. I hated math and English and reading, you know, but I was just always making art and, you know, miserable until you go to college, and then all of a sudden you realize that that's what you can do, you know, and yeah. So that's what I did.
So how, first of all, are you left-handed?
No.
Weird. I would have pegged you as a lefty just on that. You seem very right-brained, and kind of that structure and discipline of school would be, you know, you going, nah, you know. And I think that so many people in the creative fields had a difficult time with just the authoritative nature of learning, just the structure of, like, I don't want to be here because you'd say I have to. Like, if I want to learn about this, cool, I want to come and find out about it, but I don't want to be told that I have to. So you must have at least kind of made concessions to graduate and get decent enough grades to go to college, right?
Yeah, I did fine in college after I sort of found a purpose, I think, you know, and that's kind of what ceramics did for me in that sort of way, you know. But I failed a class in college. I got plenty of C's and everything, and but I still graduated with a 3.26 GPA from undergrad, so not too bad.
Nice. Yeah, that's something to, I don't know that a college GPA matters that much, but I say that as someone who didn't have a very good one. So I think that you were a better student, obviously, or were you just faking it? I mean, were you someone that it came to you so naturally, like, nah, I can just kind of breeze through this and then focus on what I really care about, or did you have to work a little bit?
I had to work a little bit, but there was plenty of getting up the morning of, writing my speech for public speaking, and then giving the speech, you know, just doing it all on that day. Mm-hmm. And from what I recall, I got A's when I did that. So it seemed, in my mind, I always put in the amount of time I would have put in normally. I just did it right at the end before it was due.
Well, do you carry that over into art? There's an interview, I think it's on YouTube, but I don't, years ago I read it or heard it, from David Foster Wallace, just being like, if your fidelity to perfection is too, I forget, his vocabulary is a lot more, he's more loquacious and eloquent, but it's essentially saying, like, if your commitment to perfection is so much so that you're unable to do anything, like, your idea will never be as good as it is in your head. The moment you touch, like, pen to paper or chisel to marble, whatever it is, you're gonna commit to making something that's less than it is in your head. You know, with that speech idea of, mm-hmm, getting up, writing it, doing it, just, bah, I just gotta get out there. Do you have exercises in your art to just go, I know I want to make this elf sculpture, but if I start on it, I'm committing myself to making it. So maybe I'll just fiddle around and do a few drawings first, or I'll make some small elves, or, you know, is that how you go about it, or is it all just one and the same?
There's a little bit of that. There comes a point with every piece where, in my mind, there's kind of like a clock ticking, and if I don't get it done by this point, I'm going to be too bored with it, and then I'll have to stop.
Yeah.
So, and sometimes, you know, the way I've set up my life, you know, with teaching and making art, but also having my hand in several different types of ceramics, you know, there's the cast mold made stuff, and then just the straight up sculptures, you know, I switch between those things, you know, so whatever I feel like doing at the time, I just focus on that. And then the other stuff kind of waits for me to be focused on that. Uh-huh. You know, like, there's that, the big Ninja Turtle sculpture I did, you know, I worked on that for a weekend, you know, probably put in like 16 hours in it on a weekend. And then I just put it under plastic, and it sat there for 2 months before I worked on it again.
Yeah, I just finished an animation last year that I drew in 2008, and then I just had it sitting there and just didn't want to do, like, the sound engineering for it. I'd only ever animated stuff and then, like, put it over music or something that had already been recorded, you know, stand-up or something like that. So to have to go in and do... And every animator tells me, like, that's the funnest part. That's the easiest part. That's like the home stretch. And to me, I hated it. I just didn't. I just let it sit, like, year after year, letting it sit there. And I think you kind of hinted at that, where you'll get bored with it. When I finished it, I still liked, in principle, finishing it, because animation's so much like tipping over dominoes. But man, it didn't resonate with me on the same way. I was kind of going, this idea is not really that. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't excite me, but I do just want to get it done. I hate having empty projects out there. Like, that turtle under plastic would just, you can hear it. It's like the telltale heart or something at night.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I just didn't, I worked on it a weekend, and then I was kind of over it for a little bit. And then just that beating heart driving me crazy.
Yeah.
Finally boiled over. I had to rip off the plastic and get back to work.
Nice.
So the way that works for me is I just have 10 things going at once, and whatever needs done the soonest, or I feel like doing the most, is what I work on.
Do you read? Are you a reader?
No. I I'm not illiterate. I can read, but I'm actually a huge audiobook listener.
Oh, okay. Well, same thing. So, like, do you? Well, I shouldn't say same thing to those very. I don't know who they are out there. The people that are. It's books or nothing. You're not gonna read if you're listening.
There's a lot of stuck-up book readers out there.
Take it easy, you damn book people. Just lighten up. So, do you go back and forth between audiobooks from time to time, or do you kind of commit to one and see it all the way through?
I usually, once I start, well, okay, I'll go back and forth between podcasts and audiobooks, I think. Mm-hmm. If sometimes a book will come along that I'm really into, and I'll just listen to that in one day, you know. But then sometimes I'll start a book on Sunday, but then, you know, The Space Cave comes out on Monday, and I got to listen to that, and then I'll go back to the book.
Yeah. Well, that's I would equate that to the same sort of thing as, and maybe I'm thinking of this only through my own perspective, but I for a long time was only just, I started this book, I will finish this book. And I always thought that I would lose my train of thought, or I'd get too distracted if I open another book or even just magazine articles. And then lately, I think it does free you up a lot more to, you know, I'm going to doodle with this drawing a little bit. Now I'm going to work on this watercolor piece, or I'm going to start this animation. And the same thing with books. Like, well, this is a nonfiction book, this is a fiction book, this is an autobiography, and I'll kind of bounce between them. And it's new to me. I haven't been doing it that long, but I think it does free you up a little bit to go, you don't have to start something and then just work like a maniac and see it all the way through and then go on to the next thing. You can kind of have a few things going.
I also think in the art making process, there is something to stepping away from your work for a little bit. You know, not necessarily for too long, but enough that you can go back and see it with fresh eyes and actually see some of the problems and issues with it before you move forward.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, like, to go to the Ninja Turtle, and if people, I'll put a link to it on the website, and or if you're in front of a computer right now, just, it's Brett Kern, K-E-R-N, art.com?
Yep, that's it.
And you'll see it there. The way it is, and it's Raphael, right?
Mm-hmm.
My favorite guy. I always liked that he was kind of quiet, the best dude.
Anti-authoritarian.
Yeah. It's weird. Even looking back, he was, to most of my friends, not their favorite. They all liked Michelangelo, who was fun-loving and silly, and then Donatello was cool. And now as adults, I think it's kind of crazy that Raphael wasn't everyone's favorite. He's such a cool guy.
He was mine. I mean, I had an older brother who was, you know, we'd play Ninja Turtles. My older brother was Leonardo. Mm-hmm. I never wanted to listen to him, so I was Raphael, you know?
Yeah, that scenario I think played out in many, many, many households around the world. But so the way you have him laying there, it's kind of seductive, it's kind of introspective, it's there's something about it where you really kind of nailed something. I don't know what it is, but there, and I think that there's a great juxtaposition there of like, well, this is a cartoon. It's a silly thing. We've all agreed it's like these turtles that live in a sewer, and yet we're seeing that, and the way it's shaped, the way it's done, it's evoking something different where I think even the silliest person is kind of going, that's what's going on there. Am I way off on that?
Well, he's actually dying.
Oh. So he's contemplative. He looks sort of seductive to me. There's something very, like, dignified.
I see that now, yeah. He's definitely, like, in bed about to growl at you or something. Uh-huh. I could see that sort of... That sort of pose. But so that whole series, you know, the E.T. and the Alf and the Ninja Turtle and Slimer are all based off of, or they're all part of the series where I'm kind of replicating ancient Hellenistic Greek sculptures in, or using 80s pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm making references between, you know, the ancient sculptures and I guess their contemporary equivalents too. So that was a piece where this gladiator is dying. You know, he got stabbed like right above his rib cage, underneath his right arm. He's just got this look, this sadness in his face and this look of pain, and he's just kind of hunched over, you know, clearly about to die. And you know, I guess our modern day equivalent, Ninja Turtles, the Gladiators. So,
yeah, yeah. So when you get an idea like that, and then to see, is there, like, people will ask sometimes about stand-up, like, where do your jokes come from? And I always think that it's similar to if you're, say, driving along or kind of riding a train or wherever you are, you're lost in thought a little bit, and then I've known you go, oh, I gotta call that person. And you don't really remember, like, the chain of thoughts that led up to that, but you just concretely know, like, oh, that makes sense. Is that something where are you looking actively for an artistic direction, or is it something where you go, oh, that's perfect, that those are our modern day kind of gladiators, that says something? Or, you know, is it not so concrete like that?
Well, I think especially for that series, it's, I have a number of kind of characters in my mind that I've identified with in some way, you know. So I talked about always pretending to be Raphael when I would play, and it always being my favorite Ninja Turtle. Mm-hmm. You know, so in that sort of way, Raphael is a metaphor for me and my past and my life and that sort of thing. So I have a number of characters like that in my mind. I don't that I would maybe sculpt one day, and they're just kind of floating there. And then I do a lot of research. I'll go see works of art. I'll read books, or I'll look through books. You know, sometimes I skimp over the words because they're not in audiobook format. But I'll look through books. I'll see sculptures. And then all of a sudden, the brain will just kind of make a connection. You know, then you know. So, like, with the Alf one, I just saw... Alf was a character I had wanted to sculpt for a while. All of a sudden, I'm looking through all of these images, and I see this old Hellenistic sculpture of this boy just strangling a goose. And it was the goofiest sculpture I'd ever seen. But it's in the Louvre, you know, which is, I think, kind of funny, too, to have to see something silly in such a serious place. But as soon as I saw that, I Alf just popped into my head, and I kind of designed it from there and then went to work.
Nice. I like that, because I think, and I hope this isn't in any way offensive, but I think that, and then anytime anyone says something like that, you're like, oh, boy.
Prepared to be offended now.
Yeah, I don't think it is. But, you know, like, the culture that we live in, the things, like, we're kind of, you know, we might be, and I don't know how old you are, but it seems like it's a pretty large swath, this current generation, that kind of mixes from quite a bit older to skews pretty young, of people that grew up kind of liking things that, unless you owned the dolls and kept them or kept season DVDs of things, you kind of went through a period of just being like, oh, that thing's not around anymore. And then Netflix and YouTube and this kind of rebirth, this people posting, hey, I do own the season DVD, and I took this scene and recorded it myself and put it on YouTube. Remember this? And then everyone starts sharing that around and going, I do remember this. And so we're kind of this collective group that might not exist a lot longer. When people grow up only knowing the things they love are available at all times, I don't think they'll have the same sense of fondness for things like Slimer and E.T. and the Ninja Turtles and whatnot. And so it's nice to hear that the origin of that wasn't just like, oh, we all miss these things, I'm going to kind of capitalize on that, but more so like, it's totally fitting that Raphael does, in a lot of ways to us, embody, you know, a gladiator. Or I like the way those things fit in like that.
Yeah, I nostalgia is pretty huge right now. Like, there's a lot of people making a lot of money on I guess the 30 something year olds nostalgia for stuff that happened in the 80s and 90s, you know. And I guess that's sort of where it comes from, that sort of thing. But a lot of times when I started sharing these images and I started making these, people will come up to me and they're like, you should do Sloth from the Goonies. And I'm like, oh, I never liked the Goonies. Sloth doesn't mean anything to me. I'm not gonna just do it arbitrarily. Like,
yeah.
Like, for me, these things are, the pieces are basically about me. I'm just using familiar characters to kind of tell the story so that other people can empathize or identify with it a little bit more.
Yeah. Are you hearing sounds like someone writing on paper with a pencil or something like that?
I'm not hearing that, but it's probably my headphones.
Oh, well. What? Oh, who knows? I like when things like that creep in. It might be annoying to people listening, but I just assume it's some sort of ghost scratching at the space cave.
I think I'm assuming that that is the microphone scratching against my beard.
Oh, maybe. That's funny. Yeah, like you were saying, like to with sloth or do this just for the sake of it. And I guess going the other direction, you know, if someone, say someone considers themselves a very serious artist and they were to take that exact same philosophy, but the gladiator going down is their youth or it's their inner child. And the way they've represented it is as blah, 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 whatever that thing is. And then we would all look at that and go, I don't know what that is. And then they would feel very content going, yeah, people get, you know, the way artists talk about like, well, that's what I was trying to evoke in people. And I don't know that every artist gets to control that. You make what appeals to you. And if people enjoy it in a certain way, that's great. But I guess when you do have 80s sort of cultural icons, you are going to have people that do say, well, do more of them, do more for me. And whereas the artist who's that pile of tires represents my innocence, they won't get that, you know. But people, not to say people won't respond to either one of them, but I think it is nice when something like Raphael is easily identifiable. But like I said, there's something just in the overall structure of it that it just seems a lot deeper than like, hey, it's Raphael, I'm just hanging out.
Yeah, that's what I was going for. I was hoping for that sort of depth to it.
Well, you succeeded, sir.
Thanks. Yeah, he's the whole reason I emailed you. One of your episodes, I don't know how many back, you were interviewing someone that was working with sea turtles, and you started talking about Ninja Turtles. And I was like, oh, yeah. Ninja Turtles.
yeah, Sheila Madrak. She's the best. She brought in her turtle Petunia. Chatted about sea life and charismatic megafauna.
Yeah, that's quite a word, or quite a collection of words there. Charismatic megafauna.
Well, that's awesome. What you are with the beard, man. Big charismatic mammal. So what do you do? Give me an idea of like your setup in Elkins. Are you in, is it Roadhouse style? When I think of Montana, I think of you having a life of like Patrick Swayze does in Roadhouse, where he's kind of off away, lives around some horses, and just has his time. If he wants to go kick a punching bag, he can do that. If he wants to take a nap on the hood of his car, he can do that. Are you in a situation where it's kind of peaceful and calm around you, or are you in an apartment and you have to drive to a space to work? What are you working with?
Well, I live in, I guess, this little, I guess it's kind of a suburb area in Elkins. You know, it's not too far from my college. I was going to say right in the heart of Elkins, but there's not really much of a heart to it. There's not too many people here. But I just live in a normal house. I can walk to the college where I work. I don't, you know, I usually have to take stuff and I can't carry it all at once, so I'll drive. But yeah, if it snows too much or my car is in the shop or something like that, it's not an issue for me to walk to school. So it's pretty close. I can go, I have access, 24-hour access to the studio where I work, you know, so I can work there in the summers. Right now I'm on winter break still, you know, so I'm in there working and there aren't students around, which is always great. But I work in the college where I teach too, you know, so the students have a chance to actually make stuff, see me making stuff. They can be exposed to the kind of hours a professional artist has to work to kind of make a living, you know. Yeah. So that's sort of a benefit of that thing.
Whoa, man, you are doing really, in a lot of ways, the polar opposite of what a number of, I would say the majority of artists are doing, which is you're being an artist full time, gets interrupted briefly by what I guess you can consider a job. I guess for all intents it is. And I got to do this job real quick. And I think for a lot of people, I got to go to this damn job. And then when I'm done, I get to do a little bit of art. And that's if I have some energy left or if I'm, you know, still motivated enough. So that sounds like a way better balance where you're, it seems like the majority of your brain function is taken up with your personal projects and what you're doing. And then secondarily is, oh, and then I'm going to teach these kids as well.
Yeah. I do try to not feel that way. I was like, come on, get out of here, students. It's, you know, because that's not good.
Well, yeah, I would have a hard time with that. I think when I get, and I think everyone's this way, and you get into something and you're, and then all of a sudden you hear a bell ring or you hear people tromp in, you go, no, I'm, damn it, I was just getting somewhere.
And yeah, I have said that before. I'm like, listen, I'll help you out 24 hours a day. If I'm here, just send me an email and tell me when you're coming so I am ready for you. Otherwise, I'm focused and I may be a little grumpy.
Do you seem pretty easygoing, and I guess everyone would comport themselves that way in like a public sort of thing as a podcast would be, but I can usually tell to a certain degree if people are, you don't seem like someone who would go, get the hell out of here.
I don't think so. It's funny. You know, there's another full-time faculty member there. He teaches the painting and the 2D stuff, and I teach all the three-dimensional sculptures and things like that. But in terms of the students, I'm kind of the bad cop, and he's the good cop.
Whoa.
I think in the grand scheme of things, I'm pretty easygoing. It's just that this other guy is so nice that compared to him, I'm the bad cop.
Yeah. I had to do that once. I mean, what you were saying about teaching and learning how to do that, I when I first got out of college and was getting into stand-up, I substitute taught, and then I taught summer school, and I just didn't want to do anything. And so I would figure out ways to get, like, the kids to grade their own tests and things, and so I never had to take anything home. And then this woman who ran the program really thought that I was onto something there, and so I sort of, like, fooled the system. She was like, that is really clever. That gets them interacting with each other. And I was like, it really just gets me not interacting with any more work when I'm out of here. And then but I, like, going into it later on, there were times when, like, I would go into classrooms and I would go into the office and they would say, this teacher for this classroom just walked out of here one day, just like falling down style, just said screw this and left. And so I would go in, and a lot of times there would be a legitimate bad cop, like a guy who was the nicest person, and they'd be going, sit down, I'll write every one of you up. And then I liked that. I thought, oh man, they really listen to this guy. So I think you do develop, if you have to, a certain affectation, or like, it's kind of a character I can play if I need kids to stop being jerks.
I think there are some things where I'm a little bit meaner than usual. One of them, this is the issue I butt heads with students on the most, is cleaning up in the studio, because we don't have any kind of like janitorial staff that will clean the ceramic studio. Mm-hmm. And breathing in clay dust is bad for you. Obviously, breathing in any kind of dust into your lungs is bad. Mm-hmm. You know, so if these students aren't cleaning up, I have to do it, or I have to breathe in a lot of dust, you know, and I don't really want to do either of those things, so.
Yeah, if it's up to me breathing in dust or screaming at people, I'll be screaming at them.
Yeah, so I usually have a pretty hard line when it comes to cleaning up after yourself and things like that. That I think, is the meanest I'll get as a teacher. Other than that, I'm usually pretty understanding and easygoing.
Yeah, I buy it. I guess, well, let's find out more, though. Let's test your easygoingness. Let's take a little break and reload on some of this Anderson Valley Winter Solstice, and then pick it up in part two with Brett Kern.
All right.
Okay. Part two next week. We'll get further into it, get more into kind of the philosophy of art and why to do it. And I really enjoy chatting with him. I like his lifestyle. I think it's real cool that he's able to teach and live where he wants to live and produce as much stuff as he likes. And if you haven't seen his work, definitely check it out. I'm sure that I'll put some links on the Twitter @space_cave, maybe even my Twitter, Huntsberger Junk, and definitely the website, thespacecave.com. If you'd like to be a guest, or you have a beer you'd like to suggest, oh, that rhymes, that's fun. Or if you have some music, or a friend who's a musician that you'd like to share, get in touch. I like our little community we're building. I may build some posters, some posters. Because my Zoom recorder is on the fritz, and I think I need to replace it. It's not recording out of the stereo mics at the top. So I might make some posters and a limited edition, a very limited run to try to offset some of those costs. But that's down the road. But if you have an idea for a poster, let me know. Tweet or email or what have you. Thanks to those of you who have sent emails via the website. I think I've written back to all of you. But if I haven't, thank you. It's nice. I'm glad you're enjoying the show. And if you want me, I guess, to read them on here, I can. But I don't know. I prefer it being our just our little communication. So anyway, you guys, I'll be in Boise, Idaho, March 24th through 27th as part of the Treefort Comedy Festival and Music Festival as well. And so come out and say hello and see that. And I'll have copies of One-Headed Beast, which you can now get directly from davidhuntsberger.com. You can stream it, download it. I have physical DVDs if you're still into that. I'll send you. I'll sign them. Anyway, let's get out of here. This is some music that was sent to me a while ago by Jas Patrick. It's from an album called Inky Ovine, and this is called Harpy. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave. Cry.
to call.